Hello and welcome to episode 91 of the podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. You can call it whatever you like, but that's what we call it. My name is David Grigg, and I'm joined as always by my co-host, the globe-trotting Perry Middlemiss. So how are you, Perry, and where have you been since our last episode?
Oh, hello, David. I think I'm starting to get my brain back together. I was in Morocco for 2.5, almost 3 weeks. Strange place to go to, you might say.
Yeah, Morocco. Why did you go there?
Well, it's always been one of those ones, those countries that it's been calling my wife and I for some reason or other, and we both had a desire to go, and we have had a desire to go for some time.
Yeah.
But we got caught up, of course, in the old global pandemic with COVID-19 and not being able to get there when we wanted to about 3 or 4 years ago. And so we finally took the opportunity to go. We booked this about 12 months ago, hoping that everything would still be okay. And yes, it all came through. It was an experience.
Mm.
Oddly enough, there were occasions when I was sitting on the bus, because we did it was a bus tour around Morocco. It's not one of those countries that I would like to just go and travel to on my own. Firstly, I'm getting a bit too old for that sort of lark. And secondly, it's a country where not everybody speaks English. There's a lot of people that do, but maybe not quite enough. Mm. And so it was better that we went on a guided tour, which we did with an Australian tour company with a whole bunch of other Australians, which made life very interesting. Mm. In a good way. Morocco's not one of those countries that people go to for the first thing. You know, there aren't all that many people that are going to say, I want to go overseas for a holiday. Oh, no, I'll go to Morocco.
Mm.
Nah. All these people are people that have travelled all over the place, and they've also travelled a lot with this particular company. So they knew what they were doing. They were seasoned travellers. And in general, the bulk of us got along pretty damn well,
so
it was great. But the interesting thing about Morocco is there were on occasions where you could doze off on the bus and wake up and look out the window and think, oh, what am I doing in Australia? I thought I was in Morocco. There was a lot of places around where it was sort of that semi-arid, semi-desert sort of countryside where it looked very much like Australia.
Mm, interesting.
Very, very, very dry. But a lovely place, really enjoyed it. Would hardly recommend it to anybody, but by God, it's a long way away.
Mm, yeah, I do.
Because it was, for various reasons, door to door on the way over was 38 hours.
Oh, wow.
So we were a bit shattered by the time we got there, and was probably 34 on the way back because we had to go from Melbourne up through Sydney, which was always a bit of a nuisance because it adds 3 or 4 hours to the trip.
Yeah.
But we were just shattered, and we got back at the end of last week and we're still basically getting over it about 3 or 4 days later, I think.
Okay.
Well, it took 2 days to do the washing, for one thing. You've got to wash everything that you've taken with you.
Sounds
so
like visiting Central Australia. Yeah.
Oh, anyway, look, really enjoyed it. Great. Had a wonderful time, looking forward to my next one,
which will be in about five months.
I'm off to India for 3 weeks in October. Got to get to these places while I've still got enough energy to be able to do it, David.
That makes sense.
Not going to happen for too much longer, so we're trying to do the hard ones while we still can.
Mm. Oh,
short, sharp trips, not 6 weeks or something, just sort of three and in and out and doing that. So anyway,
jolly good.
That's what I am. And how have you been?
Oh, I've had a few ups and downs, but I haven't been travelling anywhere the way you have. So nothing very exciting to report. I can report. I guess we've had three huge trees chopped down in our backyard. Three big cypress trees. And it was quite an exercise to have that done.
And had they just reached the end of their time and
gotten too big and starting to their roots starting to you know, interfere with the house and the neighbor's sewerage and, you know, a whole lot of things. So they were just, they've become too big.
And sometimes they become too big for a suburban backyard, and you really have no choice but to take them down to save your house at a later date.
That's exactly right.
Because the last thing you want is to have a big storm come through and knock one of them down and take out the back of your house.
Yeah. Well, we figured out my son-in-law wants the wood from it, and so we did for firewood once it's dried out. And we figured out, we did a bit of a calculation. We figured out that it must be close on 2 tons. Of wood per tree.
Whoa.
So that's a lot of wood. He's going
to
have to
move. That's a lot of wood. He's going to have to do a lot of moving.
And then splitting.
I should think that should keep him in firewood for quite some time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So
that was the excitement here.
Mm. Well, it must make a fair bit of a change to your backyard.
It certainly does. A lot more light, that's for sure.
Well, yes, but you've also, I suppose you're going to be replacing them with something.
Nothing that big, that's for sure. The funny thing was that when it was all done, we went out one night, the night after, and nearby there's a house just sort of diagonally over our back fence that's being built. They knocked down the house that was there and they're building this new house. And so it's got a frame of joists where the roof is going to be. And every joist was populated by birds staring at us. It was like out of the Hitchcock movie, you know, you bastards, you've chopped down our homes. So we sort of felt
Look, it's very sad when you have to do that, but there are just sometimes in suburban backyards where you really just don't have a choice.
No, that's right. We didn't have
and
a
the,
choice.
The trees have just got to their end of their lifespan, and sometimes they just have to come down.
Yeah, well, they did. Yeah,
and that's it.
Yeah. Anyway, that was that. Now, do we want to talk about some more general news?
Well, we can talk about some literature news. Yes David.
Martin Amis has died. I have to say, I know very little about Martin Amis other than the fact that he's Kingsley Amis's son. I've read none of his books, but you've read a couple of his books, I think.
I've read a couple. Time's Arrow, which is really a... I mean, there's been a bit of a discussion around it on the interwebs just lately because of his death. And some people are basically saying that Time's Arrow, which is a, as far as I can recall, a detective novel told backwards in time. So a bit like Counter Clock World by Dick and a fair number of other stories that people are bringing up. It's not a, wasn't a new concept when he wrote it... well, probably in the 80s, I think, but it still was quite an interesting way of handling it, and it could very easily conceive it of being a science fiction novel. I don't believe that he wrote anything that you could point at directly and say, "Yep, that's absolutely and utterly science fiction." His father, of course, wrote a couple. The major one that I can think of is The Alteration by Kingsley Amis, which is an excellent book of an alternate history.
Yeah, I remember that.
That was quite good. I believe that Amis used to read a lot of science fiction in his early days. This is Martin Amis. Mm. Used to read a lot of science fiction in his early days, but turned over towards general literature later. Mm. And was a big friend of people like James Ballard and people of that ilk. And I came across and read just yesterday or over the weekend an appreciation of Ballard that Amis wrote about 10, 12 years ago, just after Ballard died. And he really liked Ballard's work and really liked his stuff, thought that he was one of the most innovative writers of any genre in English at that time. But Martin Amis was basically mainly be remembered as one of those group of writers that came out all sort of together in around about the 70s and 80s. And I'm talking about people like Julian Barnes, Salman Rushdie, Ian McEwan, Bruce Chatwin, as well. So he was in that sort of ilk and with all of those sorts of people. He was a big friend of Christopher Hitchens, Hitchens died of esophageal cancer about 12 years ago, and unfortunately, Martin Amis has also died of the same thing. So probably a lifelong smoker,
I believe. Yeah,
smoking-related disease. Mm. And so his major novels that people are talking about are Money and London Fields, both of which are considered to be some of the best English novels published in the second half of the 20th century. I think a lot of people will go back and reread his stuff. He hasn't done a lot of big fiction novels for the last, say, 10, 15 years, I don't think. He was big in the, as I said, in the 70s, 70s, 80s and early 90s, and then sort of started to fade out a bit. But he was also renowned as a major critic and has written... some wonderful critical pieces. And if you go hunting around on the web, you'll find a number of links to some of the work that he has done. And he had a very, very intelligent and very literate turn of phrase about him. And I was reading a piece by Jeff Dyer, who's a very good English critic. I spoke about Jeff Dyer's work when we did the piece on Solaris, because he wrote Zona about watching the film of Solaris. If you recall, I was reading that book while I was watching the film itself, and that was quite a really weird and strange experience. But anyway, Dyer was a great admirer of Martin Amis's work and has written a piece about him. And so he was well known and well liked, and although he did have a big falling out with Julian Barnes, I believe, over some petty little thing, and then he moved to New York and got his teeth fixed, and the which, you know, you earn enough money, you might as well get your teeth fixed, why not? And the British critics all just got stuck into him in a big way for no particular reason. So, you know, They talk about Australia, where they chop down tall poppies, but let me tell you, I think we learned it from the British.
Yeah, that's the case.
Because they really get stuck into people as well, given any opportunity at all. Anyway, so he's gone, and that might be time to reread. As one of my friends in a fairly dark moment said, the one good thing about an author dying is at least you can catch up. that's one way of looking at it. Yeah. Not the best, but anyway, there we go. But, I might have to go back, and I've got a few of his novels up on the shelf that I've never read. So I should actually get back and have a look at them. And
I should probably actually find one of them and read them.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea. Go back and have a look at something, and then you'll think, well, how did I miss this guy all this time? Anyway, he's gone. There we are.
All right.
In other news, we have the Nebula Awards presented in the last couple of weeks. I can't remember exactly when.
Yep.
Sometime when I was away, and of course that's a complete another blur to me now. So it was sometime when I was away. Now, these are the sort of, if you like, the second or equal first, depending on which way you want to look at it, major awards in the science fiction and fantasy genres. The Nebula Awards are presented by the SFWA, which is the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association. I think they've expanded it to get rid of America and change the A to Association rather than Writers of America now, but anyway, I think they're trying to expand their compass, because there are so many members of the organisation who no longer live, who don't live in the US, that they had to make it a bit more universal. So anyway, the winners, David, the novel Babel by R.F. Kuang, which you have enjoyed and which I'm part of the way through and also enjoying. So that's good from that perspective, if you like that. The winner of the novella, Even Though I Knew the End, by C.L. Polk. I have read this, and I will be talking about this a bit later on in this episode, so I won't say anything more about this now. Novelette, If You Find Yourself Speaking to God, Address God with the Informal You, by John Chu. gone are the days of short titles, David, in the main. Although, when we come to the short story, that was one by Rabbit Test by Samantha Mills. I have read neither of the novelette nor short story, though I hope to be able to get to those shortly. Didn't have really good access to any of these when I was overseas, so I will get to them now that I'm back. You will be able to find the novelette and short story out there somewhere with links without too much trouble, and because I think they were both published in an electronic publication, so it will make them available. So that's a bit of a pointer to what might be coming up with the Hugo Awards a bit later on this year. Mm. But as we've also mentioned, because the Hugo Awards are going to be presented at the World Science Fiction Convention, which is being held in China this year, we really don't know what the Hugo Awards are going to look like. Mm. It could be anything.
Very interesting.
So I put my nominations in. Whether there's whether any of them will get up, we just don't know, no. David. But we shall find out.
Yep.
I'm expecting that the Hugo ballot will be out within the next month, because the it's been 2 or 3 weeks now since the nominations closed, and generally the hold up is the acceptance of the nomination by the authors, because they have to get in contact with everybody to say, do you want this story to appear? Mm. Because an author can, of course, refuse a nomination if they so choose, and has happened for various reasons, and any of those reasons are legitimate. But the organisers have to check with everybody to make sure that all the authors are okay with the stories and books appearing. Was that films and everything else, that so many of them all appearing, and that's a fair amount of work. Mm. And we'll have to wait and see. But I'm expecting it in the next couple of weeks. So we'll see. Talk about that maybe next episode or the episode after. Other bit of news, Miles Franklin Award long list. Yes. This Miles Franklin Award is the major Australian Literary Award. Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's the major Australian Literary Award. Been running since the late 1950s, based on a stipulation set out in the will of Miles Franklin, offering a prize for the best piece of fiction, the best work, maybe.
Mm.
I'm pretty certain there's been a drama script that has been nominated, but mostly they're novels. Mm. And I don't know whether there's been any collections of short stories. But anyway, generally they come across as novels that are being presented, but they have to represent some form of Australian life. So in other words, there's got to be something specifically Australian about them.
Mm.
Now, that means, though, that the author of these does not necessarily have to be an Australian. Mm. There's been at least one English or British writer who's been nominated because they wrote a book about the passage of people from England to Australia in the 1800s. And so basically, it's part of Australian life.
Sure.
And therefore, it fit the criteria. Mm. Yeah. And it was good enough. I think it was English Passengers, which had also been nominated for a Booker Prize, but don't quote me on that because I didn't actually go checking that out. Anyway, the major thing about the long list, I'll get to this, is that there are two books on this that we've actually discussed on the podcast.
We have.
The first of these is Robbie Arnott's Limberlost from Text Publishing, which you and I both thought was absolutely fantastic, a cracker.
Yep.
And the other one was Jessica Owl's Cold Enough for Snow from Giramondo Publishing, which I wasn't so enamoured with. I liked it up to a certain point, but only up to a certain point. I can certainly understand why people would read it and go, this is fantastic, it's absolutely wonderful, but it doesn't really go anywhere for me. So anyway, I'm not sure if there's anything else.
No, I couldn't see anything else.
I could list a whole lot of you. There's 11 on them.
I'll put a link in the show notes, don't worry.
All right, okay, that's probably about the best. But it's just good to see that Robbie Arnott's Limber Lost is there. The winner of the award will be announced on the 25th of July, 2023. Sometime or other, they're going to whittle this 11 down to a smaller number, 5 or 6, for the shortlist. And when that happens, we'll announce that.
Sure.
So we're hoping that our mate Robbie is on that shortlist. We expect and hope that he will be. The other piece of news was the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards, which were announced, I think, last night, our time. So that would be Monday, the 22nd of May.
Yep.
Now, this has come up with some rather interesting results. The Christina Stead Prize for Fiction went to Women I Know by Katarina Gibson, I think a collection of stories, so that hasn't appeared on the Miles Franklin list. The Douglas Stewart Prize for Nonfiction was won by We Come From This Place by Deborah Dank. Remember that title for a very good reason. The Patricia Wrightson Prize for Children's Literature went to The First Scientist, Deadly Inventions and Innovations from Australia's First Peoples by Corey Tutt and Black Douglas. The Ethel Turner Prize for Young People's Literature went to The Upwelling by Lister Rose. Mm. The Indigenous Writers Prize went to We Come From This Place by Deborah Dank, so that's two. The UTS Glenda Adams Award for New Writing went to We Come From This Place by Deborah Dank, so that's three.
Mm.
And the New South Wales Premier's Awards also have a Book of the Year, so basically the best of all the categories, which was won by We Come From This Place.
Oh, well, we better go hunt this book up.
We had better go hunt this book up, because that's four.
Wow.
Four prizes. This has never been done before in the New South Wales Premier's Awards. According to general reports that I'm reading in the papers this morning, a lot of commentators saying that she writes absolutely beautifully. So that is one that we're going to have to take on board and track down, David, and have a bit of a read off. So it is a non-fiction piece, and Deborah Dank is an Indigenous writer. And so we'll have to have a look at it.
Yeah, it looks good.
It deserves attention. Hmm. If you get that much, somebody wins that many awards all in one go, the book deserves attention.
Pretty good sign, yeah. All right.
Okay, that's about it, I think.
Yeah, that's quite a lot.
Well, it is quite a lot, but we're in that sort of phase where
yeah, it's the award season, isn't it?
Lots of awards are starting to crop up, you know, people are. It's cold. We're getting into winter, so people are deciding they want to sit at home and read books, which is always a good thing.
Mm.
And so, yep,
there you go.
It's good. It's good to see these awards cropping up and new authors and new books that we hadn't heard of making themselves visible, so that we can go out and track them down,
indeed. Mm. All right, so we roll into what we've been reading lately.
Yeah, okay, let's do that.
And in my case, very little.
Why is that?
I really don't know. My reading pace has just slowed almost to nothing this year. I mean, normally I set the a good reads, you know, target. You can set the target reading challenge each year, and normally I set mine at 80 or 85 or something. Look, I'll be lucky to get to 60 this year, I reckon. 60 books.
Okay.
So, yeah, I don't know what it is. I just really find it hard to read, to get stuck into reading. So anyway, that's just me.
Well,
I might get back into it.
I was doing really well in January and February, and then slowed right down in March. Picked up a bit in April and picking up a bit more in May. I'm on track for mine. I set myself a target of 100 this year, and I'm on track for that of sort of up around about 43, 44 so far. Yeah. But need to put the foot down a little bit, because there's a lot coming up that I'm going to be wanting to read, and it's all going to be read in a short period of time. So Anyway, well, that's okay. It's winter. I'm just going to sit at home and in front of the fire and glass of red and read a book. Sounds like a good thing to do to me.
Yeah. All right, well, tell us about what you've been reading.
Right, okay. Well, I jump around all over the place, as you know. And the first book that I'm going to be talking about here is a crime novel called 5 Decembers by James Kestrel. Now, this was the winner of the 2022 Edgar Award for Best Novel. Edgar Awards, named after Edgar Allan Poe, and it's given out by a major group of crime writing people in the US each year. It's generally a very good indicator of what's best in the field, and they keep coming up with people that I hadn't heard of before, and James Kestrel is one of them. So I went to try and track down to find out a little bit more about James Kestrel, and I can't find out anything. I mean, there's
maybe a pseudonym.
A publisher's blurb. There's a very interesting photo of him on the publisher's website where you can't see his face. It's a photo of him with his hand over his face looking away. You know, that's generally indicative of the fact that they don't want you to know who it is.
It might be a pseudonym, yeah.
So I think this may well be a pseudonym. I mean, the guy writes really, really well, and this is theoretically a debut novel. So if he really is James Kestrel, as he says, and this is a debut novel, he's done very, very well.
Yeah, okay.
This is a book that comes from Hard Case Crime, and I think I better give you a bit of an intro to this Hard Case Crime first so that you know what sort of genre we're coming from here. So the Hard Case Crime is an American imprint, publishers of hard-boiled crime novels, founded in 2004 by Charles Adoy and Max Phillips. And their aim is to recreate the editorial form, flavour and content of paperback crime novels of the 1940s and 1950s. Now, they've published novels by people such as Stephen King, Harlan Ellison, James M. Cain, Donald E. Westlake, Robert Silverberg and Lawrence Block, amongst many, many others. Now, some of their publications are straight new novels, like the Stephen King novels. The three, I think, that he's done are all new. Some of them are reprints, and some of them haven't been reprinted for like 40, 50 years. And some of the first publications of novels by well-known authors that have never seen the light of day before, but have been discovered in an author's archive. The quality of all these books is high, and the books are all enjoyable. They've published about 150 since 2004, so they're publishing one a month thereabouts, which is a pretty good schedule and not too bad. And they're nice paper, but they're just standard sort of small paperback sizes, and they look like the books from the 1940s and 1950s, same sort of noirish, pulpish covers on them, which are all pretty good. I think they've found a really good formula, and they seem to be producing really wonderful stuff, including this one.
Okay,
but let me tell you about it.
All right.
So this book starts in December 1941. And World War One veteran Joe McGrady is working as a detective in Honolulu in Hawaii when he's sent to investigate the death of a young man who's been found strung up and gutted in a remote shack. It's a fairly confronting image, basically, because literally he's been gutted like a sheep. Now, it soon becomes clear that this is not a normal murder case. Even if the method was enough of a clue about all this, as the victim, we later on discover, is the nephew of a very high-ranking US admiral on the island. And there's also another murder victim in the shack, and this is a young Japanese woman. Now, we're in December 1941, when there are tensions between the US and Japan leading up to...
to Pearl Harbor.
What is going to be the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, we're talking early December 1941, because attack on Pearl Harbor was very early in December. So McGrady's basically thrown this particular case. His boss doesn't want him to have it. His boss wants to sort of get over it very quickly, but because of the connection to the US Admiral, they can't really sweep it under the carpet, so they have to basically do something with it. And as they start following things around, it becomes obvious that it looks like the killer has left Honolulu and taken off on a flight over to Hong Kong. So McGrady is sent to Hong Kong to follow this murder suspect's trail, and arrives there the day before the Japanese invade. Unfortunately, he isn't able to continue his investigation because he's captured by the Japanese and thrown into a prisoner of war camp and transported to Japan, where supposedly he is going to spend either the rest of his life or the rest of the war in a sort of slave labour camp of some description. But he's only there in Japan for a day or two when he's contacted by somebody who extracts him from the camp. He doesn't know what's going on until it's explained to him that the gentleman that's doing it is a high-ranking foreign affairs official in the Japanese government. And the young girl who died in the shack was related to him. And so this Japanese gentleman realises that there's absolutely no way that McGrady can continue his investigation while the war's going on. So he sets about ensuring that McGrady is going to survive the war, and that when it completes, he can continue his investigation and find out what happens. And so what we get is a story that covers a five-year period, namely the five Decembers of the title. And it carries all the way right through to McGrady coming out at the end of the war and continuing his investigation. This is a bloody good book. I really enjoyed this book a lot. It's got a lot of that sort of noirish sort of feel that you would expect from these particular publishers and this type of crime novel. But it also has a bit of a war and adventure genres thrown into it. And it's really an intriguing novel and certainly worthwhile reading. Mm. And I just breezed through this without any problems, liked it a lot, and gave it 4.4 out of 5, yeah, David. So it's got to be one of my high-ranking crime novels of the year, I think, yeah. This one. So I'm glad I found it. And I thank the Edgar Award people for giving it the best novel for 2022.
Yeah, you think so
this,
they got it
this
right.
is a novel from 21, mm-hmm. So it's a couple of years old, but certainly worthwhile checking out.
Yeah, interesting. Yes, I mean, you're certainly right about their covers. They really have that pulp fiction look, don't they? I found
the cover wonderful,
for this one.
You know,
yeah, that's right.
Oh, well, they really are wonderful, yeah, yeah. And the titles are great. And yeah. It's just good to see somebody realizing that there was a lot of worth in that stuff from the 40s and 50s. Sure, there was a lot of pulp junk that was put out from a lot of pulp publishers that used to have house names that would just churn them out like it was going out of style. But even if you're churning out stuff all the time, sooner or later, there's got to be one or two of them are going to come up and go, whoa,
yeah.
This one stands out above the ruck. And while the writers were trying to earn a buck by writing as much as they possibly could, every now and again, any good writer is going to write a good book, and if they stand out. So these guys are trying to recreate that by putting out only good books, and they seem to be achieving that goal.
Oh, very good. Very good. All right, well, I'm going to roll on to a book. I've talked about how slow my reading is at the moment, so I've actually dug back into my archives, and this is a book I read several months ago. But I haven't talked about it on the podcast, so I thought it would be useful to add to today's mix. So, this is a non-fiction book called Unknown Shore by Robert Ruby, and it's subtitled The Lost History of England's Arctic Colony. So, it's a very interesting piece of history writing, and it's told on three levels, which is interesting in itself. So the furthest back in time is the story of Martin Frobisher in Elizabethan England in the 1570s. And he's persuaded that there's a way to reach China, then called Cathay, by sailing over the top of North America. Now, England had largely been excluded from the exploitation of the New World through a series of papal directives, which basically carved up the New World between Spain and Portugal. And England was at the time a relatively minor power and was at odds with the papacy because of Henry VIII's split with Rome a generation before. So Frobisher manages to convince enough investors and to gain the blessing of Queen Elizabeth to equip a few ships and set off. So he's looking for the Northwest Passage, as it's sometimes known. The second level to the story is that of the American Charles Francis Hall in 1859, so centuries later. A journalist and publisher, Hall had long been fascinated by stories of the Arctic, and in particular he became obsessed with trying to find out what had happened to the Franklin Expedition, which was a much later attempt by Britain to find this mythical Northwest Passage. Franklin and his crew never returned, and mystery surrounded what happened to them. There was no report back as to what had happened. So 14 years later, after that, Charles Hall believed that there was still a chance that at least some of Franklin's men might have survived in the north and been taken in by the local natives of the area, then known as Eskimos, although we now more properly call them Inuit. So Hall managed to raise enough money and supplies to set off north, but he couldn't afford his own ship, so he took passage on a whaler. Now, the third level of the story is that of the author himself, Robert Ruby, who visited these areas of interest and spent considerable time with the Inuit to research the book. It's a fascinating story. It's full of adventure and excitement. It's very well written. Now, going back to the very first level, Martin Frobisher failed, of course, to find a passage to India, passage to China in the far north, because one doesn't exist. At least it didn't back then. But in his explorations, he landed at several places. He treated the Inuit as savages and failed to learn anything from them at all about survival in the north. He kidnapped an Inuit man, a woman and her child, and took them back to England, where unfortunately they soon died. So it's still quite remarkable to think of Eskimos being in England in the Elizabethan era. However, during their initial voyage, one of Frobisher's men picked up a large black stone on one of the shores that they visited. The collection of this stone triggered off a series of further expeditions and disasters because a very dubious assay of its material back in England suggested that it was rich in gold. Spoiler, it wasn't. But Frobisher's interest in that of Queen Elizabeth turned quickly to the idea of making a fortune by mining this black rock from the Arctic. Further expeditions were mounted and a short-lived mining colony established on a small island just off what we now know as Canada's Baffin Island. So that's that furthest back level. Now we come to the second level. Charles Hall in the 1800s went to try to find the Franklin expedition. And he had some success in finding traces of Frobisher's early expeditions, but found very little of use about Captain Franklin's doomed mission. But he at least was prepared to listen to the Inuit, follow their guidance and credit what they said. But he treated them as though they were children. There's a particular passage I'm going to quote, which I was struck by, where he refers to the Inuit people who had taken him in and enabled him to survive, when otherwise he would certainly have died. And he says, the book says, he was Father Hall, and he described him as he described himself. They were his children, and he wished them to obey him. They had fed, clothed, and housed him, yet he considered them the dependents. So I have to shake your head at this sort of ignorance. Anyway, but Robert Ruby is a much more enlightened person who looking at all this, and he really did rely on the Inuit and credited them for being able to carry out his research. So each of these three interleaved stories is very well done and full of interest and unexpected turns. So it's a very, very, an excellent book. I recommend it.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it is good.
I'm going to go from that to something completely at the other end of the scale here, David.
That's all right.
I'm looking at a fantasy novella called A Mirror Mended by Alex E. Harrow. This is the second in the author's Fractured Fable series of novellas and has been nominated for the 2023 Locus Award for Best Novella. Now, you and I will remember that we talked about the 2021 novella A Spindle Splinted by this particular author, and this is the sequel to that novella. Now, the earlier one was based around the Sleeping Beauty fairy tale, with the story's protagonist, that original story and this story's protagonist, Xenia Grey, who travels to various versions of the story across the multiverse, rescuing the princesses where she can. Now, this new novella finds Grey continuing her work with Sleeping Beauty at the beginning of the story, and she finishes off one particular adventure, and she chances to look into a mirror and seems to see somebody looking back at her. And before she knows it, she's pulled through the mirror and finds herself dealing and looking at Snow White's evil queen. And Snow White's evil queen has somehow or other been able to determine that Xenia Grey is doing this work with the Sleeping Beauties, and has also determined that her, that is the evil queen's, future does not look all that good, and has decided that she really needs to be able to change things. And the only way that she's going to be able to do that is to obtain the services of Xenia Grey. Now, because the evil queen's got such a bad reputation, Grey is not going to just go, oh yeah, I'll drop in and, you know, lend you a hand. So she's grabbed Grey and basically says, well, you've pretty much got to help me out here. I've got a story that I want to have go a different way. And you find out that the evil queen is really badly done by in the fairy tales. Because firstly, she doesn't have a name. All she has is, she's referred to as the evil queen. And that's basically it. You know, there's nothing, this doesn't have any name at all. So Xenia basically ends up naming her and helping her out. And this is actually another interesting variation on this idea of reimagining fairy tales from the past and utilising the structure of them to tell a sort of different story, but also to look at them from a different point of view, because we've already ever seen one thing as good on one side and evil on the other. And as most of us will be aware, that isn't the way that the real world works. It's always shades of grey. And also, people can have fairly bad reputations that have been thrust upon them, not necessarily earned. Anyway, so while this particular novella doesn't really have the freshness and originality of that original story, how could it? Because it's doing the same sort of thing, sort of things doing over again. I still think it shows that Harrow is one of the brightest voices in this particular field. And I thought it was worthy of a read, and I would recommend it to you, David. I seem to recall you liked A Spindle Splinter.
I did. I think I should follow up on this one. Yeah.
I think you should follow up on this one. I gave it 3.8 out of 5. Yeah. So the previous one I gave 4.0 out of 5. So this one a little bit less, but still I think it continues the story very, very well.
Yeah, that's good. I guess this whole idea of taking a well-known story and turning it around or looking at it from a different character's point of view has been done a few times. I'm thinking of Wicked, which is a novel by Gregory Maguire turned into a musical, where it takes the point of view of the Wicked Witch of the West out of The Wizard of Oz. It can become a very clever way of looking at an old story.
So, we'll keep that in mind because there'll be another one coming up.
Yeah, excellent. Sorry, you mean there's a sequel?
No, there's another one that I'm going to be talking about
in
a bit later on in this episode.
Mode. All right, sure.
In the same sort of mode.
Okay. Yeah. All right, I'm going to now move on to mine then. I'm going to talk about The Dictionary of Lost Words by Pip Williams. This is by an Australian author, Pip Williams. This is her debut novel. And it cleverly entwines a feminist story into the factual history of the compilation of the first edition of the Oxford English Dictionary, which was an enormous effort which took over 4 decades, beginning in the late 1800s. So it's a fictional look at this history. So we're introduced to the main character, Esme Nicol, when she's a very young child. Her father, Henry Nicol, is one of the scholars working in the scriptorium, which is where a lot of this dictionary work is done, but it was not much more than a large garden shed located in the grounds of Dr. James Murray, the editor of the dictionary. Now, in the story, Esme's mother died in giving birth to her, and so she's been raised only by her father, though with a lot of help from Dr. Murray's servants, particularly the maid called Lizzie, who plays an important part in the story as Esme's friend and guide. So Esme grows up literally at the feet of the dictionary scholars in the scriptorium. She spends most of her time before she's old enough to go to school, crawling about under the tables and chairs where the scholars work. It's here that she picks up a slip of paper which has fallen off a desk, a slip with a definition of the word bondmaid. She's only just learning to read, so she has to spell it out letter by letter. Her father has told her that not every word sent in by volunteers will go into the great dictionary, and so she thinks that this is a discarded word, and she puts the slip into her pinny and takes it away. And this ties in cleverly with the true historical fact that bondmaid was indeed accidentally omitted from the first edition of the dictionary. So this is the author's fictional explanation of where that word went. But over time, as she grows older, Esme keeps other discarded words and starts to become interested in which words are being left out of the dictionary, not by accident, but by a conscious choice of the scholars, who are all men. Unsurprisingly, many of the words left out this way deal with women, women's bodies and women's issues, and or are words considered to be obscene. When she becomes old enough, Esme sets out to collect such words herself. She keeps her notes in an old wooden trunk and scratches inside the lid the words, "The Dictionary of Lost Words." Now, Esme's development as a character is full of interest, as is her life story, which isn't free from tragedy. Her struggles against the prevalent and unthinking misogyny of the times is a constant theme throughout the book. And these times also encompass the rise of the suffragette movement in England and the First World War, and the personal impact of these events on Esme is very well handled. And of course, the background story of the compilation of the English Dictionary adds a great deal of fascination to the story. So I like this a great deal, and I'm keen to get hold of William's subsequent novel, which is not a sequel, but it's in the same vein, as I understand it, which is called The Bookbinder of Jericho. So that's only recently come out, so I'd like to get hold of that too. So, yeah, recommend it.
Yes, I've had a couple of friends that have read it and heartily recommend this particular book. It's an interesting little side step away from Winchester's, Simon Winchester's book, The Surgeon of Cowthorpe, which was, I think, made into, or mostly adapted by Mel Gibson in, was it The Professor and the Madman, the film. So I've read that book and I have seen the film, so it'd be interesting to have a look at this and see another different version of how things happen. And it is good that we're getting this bit where people are looking at things in a sort of a different slant, and as we were just sort of saying earlier, finding a different perspective on what happened. And it's not all straight down the line, as we may have thought. There are other interpretations of what's gone on in the past, and other interpretations of history, and also of fable, that we really need to be aware of. So you get a wider view, and that's very much what has happened here with Nicola Griffith's new novel Spear from last year, 2022, which is nominated for the 2023 Nebula and Locus Awards for Best Novel. And frankly, if I'd read this before my nominations went in, I would have put it onto the Hugo nomination ballot as well, because I think it's a quite an excellent book. It's a short novel. And it's not a novella, but it's close to a novella. It's about 160, 170 pages, so it just sneaks past the novella size. So this is not one that is going to take up a huge amount of time. And really, I think she's done an excellent job. Now, the first 40 or 50 pages of this, or maybe a bit less, maybe say 30, 40 pages, started out reminding me very much of the more philosophical parts of Le Guin's Earthsea books, to be frank. And I was thinking, ooh, this is really good stuff. You know, but it slowly morphs into something else, but doesn't go completely away from that. And it's got a really good lyrical and mythical feel to it at the beginning, because it starts off dealing with an unnamed girl living with a mother in the wilderness somewhere in a cave. Now, the girl's basically learning from her mother about how the world works just in this particular area, and she's learning how nature sort of works. And she has sort of these interesting sort of abilities where she can sort of communicate and communicate with nature and work out what's going on around her. So she can basically pick up a piece of wood and know where the tree came from, well, which tree it was and how the tree's feeling, and from there to basically give her an out, spread her consciousness out to nature itself. But finally, one day she finds a dead body out in the snow. And this body's got armor. It's got a sword with the tip chopped off. It's got a helmet and a shield, and basically a chainmail cloak with leather underneath. She realizes that, you know, she just doesn't want. She's really quite fascinated with all this stuff, so she collects it off the body. And there's an interesting note that she doesn't decide to bury the body, but she leaves it naked to nature so that it can go back to nature. In other words, so that the wild animals around can devour the body and basically reintegrate it back into nature again. Anyway, she takes all this stuff back to the cave and then starts cleaning it up, because the sword's a real mess, and so is all the chainmail and all the rest. And her mother's distraught about the whole thing, because she's starting to realise that the daughter is getting to an age where she's going to leave. And the daughter does do that, takes on the name of Peredur, P-E-R-E-D-U-R, and leaves home to seek her destiny in the court of Artos, king of Caer Leon. And after a while, this... I must have been slow when I was reading this, David. I didn't really quite pick up what was going on. And it took me a while to realise that I was dealing with a retelling of the Arthurian Grail quest, and that Peredur really is Percival, and that Artos, of course, is Arthur, and there's a version of Guinevere and also Lancelot. And this is set in 6th century or thereabouts in Wales. And so So the author here has completely sort of recast everything. If you know what's happening here, you can understand what's going on. But it's told from the point of view of Peredur, Percival, and how she starts to try and integrate and wants to become a member of the company. That is the company that looks after the king. So these are the Knights of the Round Table, basically. By changing all of the names just enough, putting it on in a Welsh setting, which is reasonable enough or close enough to where you and I might have considered Camelot might have been situated. She's just changed it just enough to give you a sort of a very new and fresh look on how all this comes together. Peredur, of course, is gay, and so we're getting a queer retelling of everything that happens here with this particular quest. Now, a lot of other authors who are writing this particular thing might have stretched this novel out to 400, 500 or even 600 pages, because it's a fantasy novel. Let's chuck you know everything into it that we could possibly put in. But Griffith doesn't do that. She's paired it right back so that you've got the story and you've got enough of what's going on. She gives us everything that we need and nothing that we don't. And it's really a masterful achievement, this, I think, being able to put all of this material into this size. You get to the end of it and you think, oh, I wish this had actually gone on a bit longer. Doesn't happen with me all that often with fantasy novels, David, because normally I'm thinking, when the bloody hell is this going to end? But not with this one. And I gave this one 4.5 out of 5. I was very impressed with this, and I can recommend it.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Yes, I'm wondering whether anyone has yet tackled the idea of taking an existing legend which has a female character and make the character male. That would be an interesting turn on things, wouldn't it? I don't know that
it would be. Done. Not sure whether you get it published these days, though.
Yeah, you might. It's just interesting just to see, you know, with the gender reversals, whether someone's tried the opposite thing. Interesting. Anyway.
Well, David, your mission, should you choose to accept it.
No, I think my days of writing long fiction are probably gone by now. Anyway, right. Never mind. All right, so I'm going to talk about a crime novel. So you've been talking about your 5 Decembers. So this is a crime novel too. This is Fire with Fire, which is the latest novel by Candice Fox. And she's probably my favourite Australian crime writer at the moment. I like her novels, which are set in Australia, most of all, such as her debut trilogy, Hades, Eden, Fall. But she's also been writing some terrific thrillers set in the United States, which are all well worth reading. So, Fire with Fire. It starts with a dramatic rescue by a young woman of a drowning man just off the coast of California. After she drags him ashore, she sees that he's been very badly injured. Nevertheless, he fends off treatment, manages to get hold of the phone, and gasps out a cryptic one-word message before lapsing into unconsciousness. So we then go into the next scene, which is where we have an eager young woman, Lynette Lamb, who's just joined the Los Angeles Police Department after completing her training at the police academy. So it's the very first day on the job, and they show her where her locker is. And then after she's changed into her uniform, she's told to go up to see the boss. So she walks into the boss's office and he tells her to sit down. And he tells her that she's been responsible, however unknowingly, for the exposure of a police officer who had been working undercover for several years with a gang of criminals. And she's fired on the spot. First day on the job, she's fired on the spot. And it turns out the man saved from drowning at the start of the book was this officer, Charlie Hoskins, who managed to escape the criminals who were set to kill him, but not before they'd bashed and tortured him before he escaped. And it's at this point that a drama unfolds at the police forensic laboratory, where a married couple, driven to desperation by the lack of police investigation into the disappearance of their young daughter 2 years ago, occupy this laboratory and take several hostages. They demand that the police locate their daughter that very day, or they'll start to destroy the evidence stored at the laboratory, sample by sample. This threat is very clever, because this threat begins to open up deep rifts in the police force between the senior officers, whose prime responsibility is to ensure the safety of the hostages, and the working police people, who see the critical evidence which will resolve the cases on which they've worked so hard being destroyed. The couple occupying the laboratory have somehow found out which case each sample's related to, and they announce before they destroy that sample, you know, this is associated with that particular case. So the police chief finds herself essentially having to fight mutiny in her ranks as sample after sample goes up in flames. Now, while all that's going on, Charlie Hoskins sets out to try to find out what did happen to the couple's daughter. But of course, the trail is now 2 years old. To his astonishment, he finds that Lynette Lamb, the dismissed rookie police officer, has tracked him down and insists on helping him in his investigation. So their relationship during this very long day that they have, and the way that they end up working effectively together as a team, despite obviously initial hostility, is very cleverly done and very convincingly handled. But the tension mounts throughout, made more intense because the criminal gang from which Hoskins has escaped are intent on finding him again and killing him. And they make several attempts during the course of the novel. So the ending here certainly isn't one I saw coming, and there are a number of twists in the plot which I thought were very well done. My only criticism, if there is one, is that I felt a little more could have been done to put the reader into the minds of the desperate parents of the missing girl and how they came up with a plan to occupy the laboratory and do this. We don't get much of that at all, but that's a quibble. So definitely recommend it.
Okay, yep, she's certainly one of the major crime writers working in Australia at the moment. Worthwhile following.
Absolutely,
with everything.
Yeah. Pretty much so everything she writes.
I shall check that one out. Now, we've been talking about queer retellings of existing fables. There's also a thread inside the science fiction and fantasy genres of queer tellings of stories which use structures and concepts that have been generally male-dominated in the past. Such is the case with the next novella that I'm going to talk about, Even Though I Knew the End by C.L. Polk. This story has been nominated for the 2023 Locus Award and is actually the winner, as I stated earlier on in the episode, of the 2023 Nebula Award for Best Novel, Best Novella. Now, let me say up front that I don't really have any problem about mixing these genres. You know, here we have noir fiction mixed with angels, sorry, angels and demons. And nor do I have a problem about recasting classical stories to illustrate different points of view, because here we have a queer dark fantasy. But I really do want the author to be able to know what it is that they're doing and be able to handle it properly, and not just to throw in elements all over the place to in attempt to be relevant. The problem with this particular novella is that it utilizes a predictable plot. It tries too hard in the early stages to come across as something out of a 1940s pulp detective fiction novel. You know, there's too much, you know, knowing statements by the protagonist, and it just doesn't work for me. It just threw me out of it completely. It starts off well, it looks great, and then she tries to set up this sort of noirish feel, and it just, you know, just goes awry. Anyway, the main character, Helen Brand here, is a private detective with magical powers who was at some time in the past booted out of the Magicians Union for committing an unforgivable act. We don't know what that act is, although we do find out later on what it was and why she was excommunicated. And she's hired by this person called Marlowe, which is another throwback, which I wish people wouldn't do very often, to Raymond Chandler. Hired by this person, Marlowe, to look into what appears to be a ritual killing. And before long, she has run foul of the legitimate magicians who are also investigating this and the subsequent follow-up murders, because murders just keep on happening. But it all becomes very predictable. And as the storyline progresses, you can see the wheels turning and the outcome slowly approaching, and you think, okay, it's going to go. No, it doesn't. Yeah, it goes there. It just goes exactly where you think it's supposed to be going to go. Now, I'll give the author some points for the attempt, but unfortunately, it just falls down to the execution. And if they had worked on trying to get the plot a little bit more twisty and a little bit more unpredictable, it might have been okay. But nah, this one just doesn't work for me. I don't really know why this won the Nebula Award. I just can't see it. It just doesn't do it for me. I give this one 3.3 out of 5. I liked some of Polk's ideas about how to set it up, and it had possibilities, but to me, it just needed a big edit over the top to sort of say, nah, this doesn't work. This doesn't work. You need to work more here and work more there. Anyway,
Yeah, not everything works.
not everything
Yeah.
works. This one for me didn't.
Didn't. Yeah, okay. All right, well, my last novel I'll talk about is a book called Red Team Blues by Cory Doctorow, which has just come out. Cory Doctorow is a Canadian-born writer and blogger who in recent times has been writing many, many articles focusing on the way huge corporations are destroying civil society and the planet, all in the name of profit. All his writings are well worth following up, just on that basis. But he also writes fiction. And I've only read a couple of his novels before, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, and Little Brother. The latter in particular picks up on his political views, and he shows his commitment to his sort of principles by releasing all of his work under a Creative Commons license without any digital rights management or DRM. And in fact, he refuses to let audiobooks of his work be sold through Audible because they insist on applying DRM to everything that they publish. He just won't let them publish his books. So let's look at this particular book. I suppose you'd describe Red Tea and Blues as a techno thriller. It's got all the elements of a private detective story with a tense plot, but the focus is on technology and the tools of the detective in this kind of book are laptops, mobile phones, networks and software. The protagonist is Martin Hench, who's a 67-year-old forensic accountant and security consultant, who, as the story opens, is largely retired and spends his time travelling around in a bus which has been converted into a luxury mobile home. He bought it off a rock star who was leaving the business, apparently. Now, as a software security consultant, Hench is usually on the red team, the group who try to break into systems to exploit, to expose their vulnerabilities. The blue team plays defence and tries to harden their networks and systems against such attacks. The red team, Hench notes, always has the advantage, being able to try all sorts of different attacks, whereas the blue team only has to make one mistake and they've lost. But, of course, this isn't really a game at all, and losing can lead to severe real-world consequences. So Hench is contacted by an old friend, Danny Laser, who's been trying to set up a new cryptocurrency system, think Bitcoin, which doesn't eat up vast amounts of computing power and electricity, as does Bitcoin and the rest of such systems. Now, Danny has illegally obtained some highly critical cryptographic keys, which would allow him, among other things, to rewrite the cryptocurrency ledger, something which is meant to be impossible. Now, the keys were on a laptop he'd placed in what was meant to be a highly secure facility, and the laptop had been modified so that no wireless or internet connection was physically possible on the device. And the laptop could only be opened up and used by someone possessing a unique hardware token, a small little device which gives access to it. Despite all his precautions, however, Danny's hardware token has been stolen by a pickpocket, and the laptop shortly afterwards disappears from the supposedly secure facility. Now, together, these two items could give the bad guys terribly dangerous control of software systems worldwide. So Hench sets out to find out who stole the token and the laptop before they can put the stolen cryptographic keys to use. And he leverages his long experience and knowledge of computer systems. It's not long before he thinks he knows who the thieves are and where they're hiding. But there's more than one group of bad guys trying for the price, and gruesome things happen. Worse, Martin Hench finds himself blamed for what's happened and has to go on the run. And throughout all of this, Hench relies a great deal on his friends and contacts, including two very smart women who manage to, between them, to pick him up and sort him out when things go badly wrong, which of course they do. So this was a real page-turner for me. I read it in a couple of days and I enjoyed it a lot. I did feel a bit let down by the ending of the book, which I thought was a bit too tame and pat for some of the hazards that he faces earlier on. It's sort of, you know, it's a bit too easy at the end, I thought. I kept expecting one of those last-minute, ho-ho, you think the danger's over, but... moment, but in this case it didn't happen. And to read this book, it certainly helps a great deal if you understand at least a little of the underlying technology behind the story. Otherwise, I think you'd definitely struggle. Not to mention missing little jokes like the name of Hench's bus, which is Unsalted Hash. But as a computer nerd myself from way back, I lapped it up. I really enjoyed it. So there you go.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah. That's all my books.
Wow, that's all yours. Well, I just want to finish off with some quick observations about a film that I saw on the plane. Interestingly enough, this is on the plane on the way back from Morocco. It had a little note on it saying that a little warning before the film was shown, saying that it shows flight accidents and flight incidents, and viewers of a nervous nature should not watch this should not watch this film, especially on a flight. Well, okay, I think you'd have to be really pretty bloody nervous, because you're not given very much time to actually digest anything in this particular movie. The one that I'm talking about is Top Gun Maverick from last year, starring Tom Cruise. This is a sequel to the original Top Gun from 1986. In some ways, you can see why Tom Cruise bothered, why he wanted to make this, get this film made. by the end of it, I wonder whether we really care whether he made it or not. Because here we're presented with the same old tired storyline and characters. You know, the military command comes up with this impossible mission in enemy territory. They assemble a crew of possible participants and engage the only old guy still around who was dumb enough to teach them how to go about doing it. Military command hates him. The filmmakers love him. And these students are just so, you know, he's an old bastard, but you know, that's all we've got. But they're going to love him in the end. But of course, the students all fail to make the grade. But the old guy, he's the one that knows how to do all this, and he shows them how it can be done. And this is really paint by the numbers filmmaking, David. I mean, you just basically put everything together and just fill it in. It's competent enough and it gets the job done, but oh my God, do we really have to wonder why the job had to be done in the first place? It's just, oh, there's everything here is predictable, including some scenes that I mean, I think I've seen the first film. I can't remember. I've seen scenes from the first film, and I'm absolutely certain I saw a scene where Tom Cruise is on a motorcycle racing a jet as it's taking off. There's another one of those. So that's predictable. There's basically the love interest. Look, his new girlfriend, who's supposed to be the old girlfriend, but I don't know, runs the local bar and is a single mother and has a the daughter, the kid, the child is disaffected and not terribly sure she likes Tom Cruise hanging around. And oh my God, the rescue go to, well, the mission takes off, it all goes, everything sort of goes well, and you know that somebody's going to die, but it's probably the one that you hated the most anyway, so that's okay. You know there's going to be a problem, you know there's going to be a rescue, you know they're all going to come back, and you know they're all going to be happily ever after and lots of cheering. How the hell this ever made the best film nominee list at last year's Oscars is totally and utterly beside me, beyond me. I just don't understand this at all. And I suspect it might actually be the worst nominee in all of Oscar history, to be perfectly frank. There's probably been some worse
I
ones.
I imagine they have.
By God, this is just tedious. Look, okay, it's completely tedious the whole way through. I sat through it because I really just, my brain was dead by this stage, and it's about the only way you can really watch it. They're okay, there's some nice flying shots. That's it. No. Don't bother. Don't even bother to watch it when it's on streaming
Well, I
because
would not like it to.
it's really just going to be the waste of 2 hours of your life.
It's interesting, isn't it, how some of these old guys are sort of revisiting the golden hits of the past. I'm wondering about the latest Indiana Jones movie, although I believe that seems to be getting good mentions, but I haven't seen much of it.
It seems to be. I mean, what was it? The one about the crystal skulls and the aliens, I didn't think much of. The first and the third of them. So this is number five, I think. The first one, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Last Crusade were both pretty good. The second and fourth, not so flash. Maybe this is going to be one of those ones where the odd numbers are going to be the best,
Maybe.
and number five is going to be all right. I'll go and see it.
Yeah, I
David,
probably see it, yeah.
I will go to the cinema and watch Indiana Jones and just hoping to God that it's better than number four. But I'm glad I didn't pay money to go and see this at the cinema. And I know a lot of people really liked it, but I don't know why. I
No,
really
no,
don't know
Tom
why they
Cruise
like
doesn't
Top
much
Gun
appeal.
at all.
No.
No, it has no appeal to me at all.
No.
Anyway,
There you
there we
go.
go.
All right. Well, I
So
think.
there we are. We're finished on that poor note. So I'm
That
sorry
poor
about
note.
it,
That's
but
all right. Just
I
again.
thought that it needed to be reviewed, and I thought something needed to be said
Oh,
about
well,
it.
that's
And
fine. That's fine.
people need to be warned off, even though it is almost a year old, this film, but there we are. Try and stay away from it.
All right. Well, I think that's probably covered us for the day.
I think it probably has.
So we'll wind up and we'll see you next time. But what do we talk about next time? Probably just more books, I imagine.
Probably just more books, maybe a few films as well. I'll try to get to a few. I know that I've got to go along and see Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. My son says that he liked number one, didn't like number two, but he thinks number three is probably the second best of them. So
Okay.
again,
Maybe the odd
one and
numbers
three
count, yeah.
seem to be the goes, the odd numbers. So I'll go along and have a look and Let see what it's know. Like and yeah, report back.
Very good.
And there's a couple of other interesting films floating around which I'd like to have a look at, but I will not mention those in case I don't actually get to them.
So right, right.
I'll talk about them if I can see them in the next couple of weeks.
No worries.
All right, David.
Okay, I'll catch you next time.
Yep.
Okay.
See you then.
See you then. Bye.
Bye.